Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
So this is a presentation all about the Woodford Equity Income Fund. And titled it A Forensic Investigation of the Woodford Equity Income Fund History. Now, I never invested in Woodford, and really, you might know me as running Stockopedia. Just out of interest, how many are Stockopedia subscribers here? Quite a few of you, but if you're not, would you put your hands up? It's quite useful because some of the introduction goes through some of the data and how we analysed the holdings. So, obviously, Woodford has been covered to death by the press. At Stockopedia, we cover, at the moment, predominantly equities, so stocks. But we're thinking about adding sort of in-depth fund analytics next year or at some stage in the future. And this I wanted to do as a case study to really dig into the value we could actually provide in analysing funds. Anyway, this was an hour-long presentation, but David's told me to try and stick to 40 minutes. So I'm going to rattle through. I ran this as a webinar a couple of weeks ago, and we had lots of people online. Maybe some of you heard it. And it was a very, very in-depth study. So I'm going to try and switch through some of this. Now, what I'm going to do, a little potted history of Woodford, I'm sure you all know it. I'll introduce the analysis framework, and then I'm going to run through the holdings, the actual holdings he had on a range of years between the launch of the fund in 2014 and the end of the fund in 2019. And then I'm going to do a summary of charts across the whole time frame and provide some lessons for investors. That's me. I'm Ed Pagecroft. I'm the CEO, founder of Stockopedia. And this slide, if you can read it really quickly, it would help because we're under time pressure. But I'm sure you get lots of these. But we're all DIY investors, etc. And that's all you need to know. So Woodford obviously made his name at Perpetual, 1988 to 2014, before he set up on his own. And this slide came from the Telegraph. Obviously, he started in like 88, and that's the UK all companies benchmark, and there's Woodford's performance. Did really, really well. He's held, you know, shunned.coms, held tobacco shares, sold banks early. And, you know, he really did have stunning performance all the way up to the end in 2014. And, you know, that's why he started to become known as the greatest fund manager of his generation. And eventually he obviously decided to go on his own. But in 2012, the FT reported that he'd invested 252 million while he was at Invesco Perpetual in speculative US biomass conversion group Xyleco. And that made the new US owners of Perpetual, Invesco, very unhappy. And they took steps to try and prevent him ever doing this again. And that obviously made Woodford very, very cross. The FT reported that the American owners and risk constraints were not the top of his friendly list. So 2 years later, Woodford left Invesco and set up on his own. So this is just a quote from a kind of industry, someone from Chase de Vere, but sort of typical perception of Woodford in the industry. It'll be impossible for Invesco Perpetual to replace Woodford with somebody of similar standing because, particularly in the world of UK equity income funds, there is nobody of similar standing. And that was a general consensus. There was even the K report. I don't know if anyone remembers the K review. And he name-checked Neil Woodford as the kind of great fund manager who was able to make off-benchmark bets and really as a standout fund manager. So he set up on his own. And lots of great marketing. Woodford goes it alone, sets up in Oxford on the Ring Road. We're in Oxford at RHQ. And he got off to an absolutely flying performance from 2014. Really did well in the first year. you know, peaked in about 2017, and then we all know about the decline. Now, I know you probably all know about this story, and I'm sure some of you invested in Woodford. And you don't need me to spend lots of time going over this old story. It's been done to death in the press. But the key thing is, why? Why? What happened at Woodford? Now, the press has covered all the anecdotal evidence, and what I thought we could add to the discussion is a little bit more analytical rigor on what really went wrong in the fund and in the fund holdings. So I want to quickly, a lot of you who are StockBeater subscribers will know our framework for analysis. And I'll just rattle through this because there's some other bits and pieces which are helpful. And this will help frame the analysis I'm going to show you of his actual portfolios. So first of all, where did we get the data from that to analyze his fund? Well, we did. I had an intern over the summer who did a lot of the kind of legwork in getting actual the portfolios. One of the things Woodford did to his credit was he was very transparent about what he held. So he actually started publishing his portfolio quite early. So we actually got quite a lot from Woodford Capital itself, although that website is now decaying and then being shut down. Got quite a lot from Funds Library, some from The Telegraph, and from a variety of annual reports. So that was a little bit of work. Now, what we do, Stockopedia, is we do all our share analytics, as you probably know, but you might not be familiar with where a lot of the raw data comes from. Thomson Reuters span off a lot of their data collection and distribution business into a service called Refinitiv, which is now being bought by LSE. But they have thousands of analysts all over the world who gather and aggregate company data, and they put it in databases in their cloud, and we download it onto our servers every night, where we then do about 60 million computations a day, which then creates all of our databases and our calculating financial ratios and our rankings and all that stuff. And that's what ends up on the website. So the great thing is, as we've been doing this for years, we've got this data on stocks, on all of Woodford's holdings and holdings history. And that's where I thought this would be quite interesting, to use this historic data to analyze his holdings. Now, this is just a stock report, and I know a lot of you will be familiar with our stock ranks. So some of this analysis is based on the stock ranks. So Woodford never owned the train line, but I'm not sure if you can see there, but we do this analysis using all our financial ratios and publish these ranks, the quality, value, and momentum rank for every stock in the market. And these are percentage ranks, as most of you know, from 0 to 100, where 100 is best. And so we basically have this sort of composite measure of a company's quality, which is based on profitability and cash flow, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, 100 is best, 0 is worst. Same for value. So cheap stocks, 100 is cheapest, 0 is most expensive. And momentum, 100 is strongest momentum, et cetera. So it's not explaining it is not rocket science. It's a bit more complicated under the hood, but I think we try to make it really understandable. So that's the first thing to understand. And yes, the highest ranking shares have done very well. Now, I think this is really important because this is not just, you know, these returns that accrue to better, more profitable shares, sort of more inexpensive shares, stronger momentum shares, tends to, is very well known by professional investors. So the rankings from zero, low ranking shares have historically annualized negative returns. Higher ranking shares have annualized higher returns on average. Now, any good fund manager knows this in general. They might have different ways about going and accessing these returns, their own proprietary methodologies that might analyze intrinsic valuations, et cetera, et cetera. But in general, this is what investors are trying to do. They're trying to earn that premium from the market. So I'll just skip that slide. But that's the key insight. Now, we also classify stocks in the market using these little classifications that are up at the top of these stock reports. So if I didn't explain, these are some of the data on stock reports. It's a little bit washed out on this presentation. But these show the sector, the risk rating, which I'll be using quite a lot, and I'll explain a little bit more, the size group, so is it large cap or small cap, and what we call the style. And let me just explain each of these in a little bit more detail before we go on to Woodford's holdings. So the sectors, there are 10 sectors that all stocks are classified in. And I know I'm probably teaching, I know most of you know this stuff already, so I'm sorry, but just sort of reiterating it. The sectors are basic materials you find, mining shares, consumer cyclicals, which might be autos or people that sell fridges, that kind of thing. Financials, consumer defenses, which is often more based around, you know, things like food and tobacco and the things you might need every day. You often find pharmaceuticals in there. Healthcare stocks, utilities that keep our lights on, industrials, energy stocks, telecoms, technology. And these are the 10 sectors of which every stock is allocated in our system. And they're across three super sectors, but I won't go into those. But just remember there are 10 sectors. These risk ratings, now this is a proprietary thing that we have on Stockopedia. When people buy shares, they often don't know about the risk. You all being here probably love small caps, probably love micro caps, and might be unaware sometimes of quite how speculative those shares are. But we have this five-banded risk rating, goes from conservative through to highly speculative. So five bands, conservative, balanced, adventurous, speculative, highly speculative. This is all based on the volatility of the share. Now, I know the volatility is just a proxy for risk, but that really is how much the share price bounces around. And often, so very small speculative shares can often bounce around a lot, and that's because they're quite speculative. Whereas large, safe companies tend to sort of do this, and they're less risky. And so this very easy to understand risk rating gives a very quick understanding of that. And this is going to become very useful when we look at Woodford's Holdings. So just remember that. And the key insight before we look at Woodford's Holdings, and again, most professional investors do realize this, but conservative shares in blue, and as the risk goes up, the conservative, balanced, adventurous, these are the less risky parts of the market, tend to have pretty solid returns on average. Whereas speculative and highly speculative shares, on average, tend to do worse. And highly speculative shares, they're like lottery tickets. Like someone wins, but I'm afraid the majority of lottery tickets, as we know, lose. And so highly speculative shares, on average, tend to lose. You might buy one and find you've made 100 times your money. Woo! But mostly, if you buy 100 of them, you're gonna lose on average. So it's a bit like betting on all, you know, you go to the races and you bet on all the outside horses, right? You might have a good day, but if you do that for a lifetime, you do end bust. So that's key. We're going to look, and this is going to be very useful for understanding Woodford. Size group, very obvious. Large caps, mid caps, small caps, micro caps. And we have, you know, large caps being really like the FTSE 100. That's like the FTSE 250. And these are much smaller shares. And I'm not going to go into much detail on this, but we do. But it's quite useful for analysing how Woodford's style changed. But I'm not going to go into too much detail with that. But it's essentially probably too much detail for this presentation. Anyway, all you do need to know about the styles is that we have certain classifications of shares that we classify as winning styles, and certain classifications as losing styles. And the one that's particularly interesting is this one, which we call a momentum trap, which you can see this is quality, value, and momentum. And this is when a stock or portfolio actually gambles it all on momentum, but has no quality or value backing it up. And we call that a momentum trap. And I'll be showing you how Woodford's portfolio became a momentum trap. Anyway, I hope that wasn't too fast and you've got the general gist. So, and it's going to be very interesting now. We've found the first ever published 2014 portfolio of Woodford's. He came out and he published it, and we found it in the Telegraph. He said at the time, and I don't know if anybody did invest in, but did anybody here invest in the Woodford Equity Income Fund or Patient Capital? You know, don't be shy. I know that a lot of people did. And, you know, I'm sorry if you're still stuck in there. And you know, it's a real... This is so many hundreds of thousands of people have been involved in this. And I personally think that it's there were so many things that went wrong at Woodford, and it should have been caught earlier. I wish we'd done this presentation earlier, because I think we could have helped. But this story is going to run and run for a long, long time. At the outset, it was an equity income fund, right? I believe I can find enough safe, reliable, attractively valued companies to build a portfolio which, in aggregate, can deliver an attractive, long-term, risk-adjusted return. Safe, reliable, attractive, long-term, risk-adjusted return. That's Woodford's own words, a slow growth strategy. May 2014. And of course, it was pitched as an equity income fund. I'm focused on the equity income fund here because it was the biggest fund, had more than 10 billion at its peak in it, probably more than two thirds of the assets under management. And you know, it really is a key insight into everything that was going on there. Now, in 2014, they went public with their holdings in July 2014. It was an unprecedented move, hugely transparent. This is just some of the key top holdings. You can see some of the big, lots of names you recognize. You know, household names like GlaxoSmithKline, British American Tobacco, BT, Imperial Tobacco, Rolls-Royce, Very little there that is, you know, you might think, what is that? You might find things like a couple in there, Prothena, Allied Minds. I mean, there are a few things you might not have heard of, but generally it was fairly familiar. Now, this chart shows you all of those names on what I call a bubble chart. And we publish these on the site for all portfolios. But on this axis, they're very, very easy to understand. Each of these blue dots is one of Woodford's holdings on that date. On this axis is the value rank I showed you earlier, from expensive to cheap. So the cheapest shares with the highest value rank are up high up on this chart. And this is the quality rank. So, and it's from junk or zero, low ranking shares, unprofitable shares here, and good shares here. And you can see that generally the portfolio was focused on good, cheaper shares, what you might expect. And a few more speculative investments down here, but generally, that this is what I would say is a composition of a pretty well-managed fund, okay? If it's looking for those sort of safe, reliable, attractively valued companies. So that just remember that picture. Then we looked at the average, sort of weighted average exposure to each of those ranks, those quality, value, momentum factors. And you can see here, this shows you in blue the quality rank, which was high, almost 70. For the average quality of the holdings was pretty high. In terms of value, it was a little bit pulled down by some of the more speculative, expensive ones, and then slightly more exposure to momentum. I would call this a strategy which looked at some of the more premium quality names in the market, like the AstraZenecas and the Glaxos. And so nothing too out of the ordinary there, but a pretty good, safe, quality portfolio. Now, this is pretty interesting because he was invested 76% in large caps, mid caps, small caps, and there was a small quota of unlisted shares and some things we couldn't get any data on, which were preferred stocks and so on. But the minority was in sort of smaller, more speculative shares. So again, still pretty safe, big cap, large, reliable shares. This is the Woodford Equity Income Fund. Mark Dampier, become quite notorious from Hargreaves Lansdown. I've known Neil for 20 years and I've been invested with him for most of that time. He's never particularly let me down. He's been a very non-benchmark manager, which is exactly what I want. Otherwise, you might as well go passive. I mean, it's true, you probably do want a non-benchmark manager if you're in an actively managed fund. But you know, as we'll see, there are things that can go wrong. Now, I think looking at all the sector distribution of that portfolio, remember I showed you the 10 sectors, I've put the FTSE All Share in grey here and the percentage of the portfolio allocation here. So you can see the FTSE All Share, it's quite high exposure to energy, financials, basic materials, consumer cyclicals. Woodford had this big overweight in healthcare stocks. He also was, so when the blue line's bigger than the grey line, it's an overweight. Nothing in energy, didn't like energy, nothing in technology at that time. Mostly overweights in consumer defensives, healthcare stocks, industrials. That's very much because he had large exposures to tobacco stocks, big pharma, etc. But that was quite a noticeable overweight, almost 30% of the portfolio, more than 30% of the portfolio in healthcare, of which 24% was in large cap healthcare. AstraZeneca, Glaxo, Roche, Sanofi, Novartis, big European healthcare stocks. So it was a big sector punt, big sector bet, but it was still in pretty much reliable household name stocks. Then in December 2014, he said, "We have invested a small proportion of the fund's assets in several early stage businesses, some of which are quoted, some unquoted. This part of the market is unloved and undervalued, and consequently, I believe it represents huge untapped potential, sign of things to come." And I think, you know, looking at the risk ratings, you know, I showed you we have this risk rating on every single stock. Over half of the portfolio is in conservative low-risk shares. And in terms of speculative and highly speculative, you know, which I showed you, tend to underperform the market. It was quite a low proportion. Now, I do think it's okay for people to buy highly speculative and speculative shares if they're a minority of your portfolio. Because you've got to think you've got key insight on some of those shares. You might have information others don't. But if your whole portfolio is full of those shares, you're going to end up, well, either get lucky, you go bust, or you underperform. So this, nothing too dramatic here. The unlisted quota was pretty small. And anyway, I think that's quite an important chart. Now, in terms of the exposures versus the benchmark, you can see that he had far more conservative shares than the FTSE All Share. And, you know, very little in the middle, and then a little bit of a more exposure at the other end. But generally, you know, he's got a kind of what I might call a bit of a barbell. He's got like more exposure on safe stocks and he's got some punts at the other end. There's nothing too out of the ordinary here. But 2015, the BBC, there's a piece on the BBC website and it said, June 2015, a year after the launch, this weekend, hundreds of thousands of small investors, many of them pensioners, will be saluting Britain's very own Warren Buffett. Since he launched his own fund exactly a year ago, Neil Woodford has delighted investors with an 18% return on their cash. He'd had an amazing year out of the gates. He'd had this flood of money coming in and he'd kept throwing it into, you know, some of those big caps and lots of the other shares. You know, maybe some of that performance driven by great stock picking, maybe some driven by fund flows. This shows you, I think, I'm not sure, when they launched, they had a sort of big sort of, they had quite a lot of money from St. James's Place, etc. Hargreaves Lansdown ramped up their marketing. You can see from 2014 to the end of 2015, assets under management rocketed above 8 billion. And this is just in that Woodford Equity Income Fund. I remember, I think the Patient Capital Trust launched about here. But you were seeing this massive influx of assets under management. And, you know, you can imagine, I think within like 12 months, it became the second biggest fund in the all equity, sorry, in the income sector of the UK. It's almost unprecedented fund launch. So all that influx of money coming into a small team, and that they've got to invest it. And they can start writing some very, very big checks. And he popped up in 2015 in a blog on the website, British Science, Great Shape. The pharmaceutical sector still looks very attractive in my view, but the opportunity doesn't exist only amongst large mature companies such as AstraZeneca and Glaxo. We're also very excited in the long-term potential in smaller, earlier stage pharma businesses. So he'd situated himself in Oxford. There's lots of Oxford spin-outs. And, you know, he got, you know, his network included sort of executives who were putting him in touch with lots of these businesses. And he thought he could make a difference here. Looking at 2015, there were five key contributors to performance. And I think you can see, this was a thing we took from a TrustNet article. Three of them, so there's two tobacco stocks, Imperial Tobacco, and then BT, had contributed a few percent each. But then these two, highly speculative shares, Stratified Medical and Prothena, in healthcare, very highly speculative. And I think what's interesting is like, he made almost five times the money on the investment in that one. These ones are much more slow growers. So he started seeing that certain high speculative shares could rocket. And as you can see, quality, value, momentum, these tended to be lower ranking. These ones tended to be higher quality. More like what you might have expected him, him to be going after. But maybe his head had been somewhat turned by some of these early big wins. You know, did he get lucky on those early investments? I don't know. But in 2016, he was very focused on early stage healthcare stocks. You're starting to see, that there were more of these kind of healthcare sector names that you've not heard of. And all the way down this list, you start sort of finding sort of more speculative investments. He started writing some big checks to unquoted shares and more speculative investments. This is the same bubble chart, but for his 2016 holdings. So remember, each of these blue dots is a holding. Gone is that big exposure to the high quality, high value, high quality shares. Suddenly, you've got this concentration of what I call at Stockopedia expensive junk shares. because they are very low ranking on both of these dimensions. So it had been like a drift into this area of the market. And, you know, I, in all my webinars, I always say, if you upload your portfolio and it looks like this, start having a look in that other end of the market. You might do better. And this, I mean, you know, this is not rocket science. This is, these are the quality, value, momentum, the change from 2014 to 2016. The average quality fell enormously. The average value fell enormously. In other words, it got more expensive. And the exposure to momentum went up. I would call this the style of a momentum trap portfolio. Strong momentum, but weaker on quality and value dimensions. It was a huge tilt towards momentum. In all their marketing, you see him critiquing momentum investors. But they, if you look at the holdings, it was starting to look like a momentum fund. If you look at the sector diversification, again, FTSE All Share in gray, Woodford in blue. Woodford's healthcare bet, which remember started with safe big cap farmers, it was now 40% of the portfolio. That's a huge bet in a £10 billion fund. It started to resemble a much more like a sort of single sector bet. The risk rating diversification of the portfolio. Remember, there was more than 54% in conservative shares at the start. That had halved in 2 years. The amount of unlisted, highly speculative and speculative shares had radically increased. The unlisted and highly speculative exposure had doubled to more than 25% in 2 years. And this is just a case study of the kind of share that he was buying, Northwest Biotherapeutics. This is a quote from Best Invest. Investors in the Woodford Equity Income Fund might reasonably be asking, why on earth a UK fund, which is described as offering exposure to companies that can deliver sustainable dividend growth, has an illiquid holding in a US biotech stock that's never paid a dividend? Northwest Biotherapeutics, he invested here, it rocketed. And then there was a shorting attack, allegations of financial improprieties, regulatory failure, it fell. I believe it was sold by Woodford Capital as part of their kind of raising of funds in 2019 for 24 cents. And at the time, it had a stock rank of 19. So this is a classic example of a share that was expensive, a low value rank, a low quality rank, and even poor momentum. We would have classified it as a sucker stock on Stockopedia. But anyway, he put 180 million into it. You know, this is the guy with all the cash, you know, a guy with billions to invest. People were going to him. Now, I think this is really important. At that point, at the zenith, what did investors sign up for? A high quality safe income fund or a speculative healthcare momentum fund? There was 35% of the portfolio in speculative and unlisted stocks. 40% of the portfolio at the peak was in healthcare stocks. And the average momentum rank in that portfolio, weighted by position size, was 62. So, I mean, I think that's quite extraordinary, if I'm totally honest. 2017, the fund was massively committed to speculative and unlisted securities. Yes, I mean, a lot of those big cap pharma stocks had gone. You know, where are all those big cap pharma shares? They've all gone apart from AstraZeneca. You're starting to see things like Prothena becoming big, big parts of the portfolio. Yes, there's the Burford Capitals, the Purple Bricks, well known by private investors, Benevolent AI. You start seeing things like Alchemy. Remember, this is just the top holdings, and he had many, many. Oxford Nanopore showing his Oxford-centric area. This is the assets under management chart. It's like a mountain, boom, from launch, boom, 2017, more than 10 billion. And then suddenly, as I show you, what happened is there's this terrible performance and decline in assets under management as there became redemptions. In 2017, at the zenith, the average momentum rank had shot up. The quality and value had shot down. His portfolio had no exposures to low exposures to good quality and cheap shares. You know, the dynamics of the underlying dynamics of the portfolio had completely transformed. And in 2017, at that peak assets under management, Jupiter, this shows you the inflows. into Woodford equity income. And then these are the outflows across time. And you can see he generally was having inflows all the way up through to 2017, and then outflows persistently. But Jupiter pulled 300 million that in 1 month in 2017. And this is why John Chatfield Roberts, head of, I think, external funds at Jupiter, said we had lost confidence with what was happening with the fund. When we had started, there were 6 unquoted in the fund. And by the time we'd sold, there were 45. If he'd worked at Jupiter, it just wouldn't have happened. Now, I think it's really interesting because Woodford at Invesco Perpetual, presumably, as we saw earlier with that Zyleco investment, when he was at Invesco, he was in trouble about that with their firm's risk department. And the thing is, these big asset management firms have these, you know, quite clear risk constraints, and they kind of stop their fund managers from going and doing silly things. Now, Woodford, on his own, with everyone being treated like a, I mean, if anybody was being treated by God, by the British press and the culture, it was Woodford. And I presume the culture in the firm was that, you know, whatever he said went. You know, he was a superstar. And, you know, it just shows the behavioral biases we have about believing this halo effect around people. And obviously there just weren't, I don't know. I don't know what happened there. I can't say what the risk, you know, constraints were like. But just looking at the portfolio, you're seeing that there weren't enough of them. And I think it's really interesting when you get industry insiders like him saying this. I thought this was a really interesting case study because I know lots of people, lots of private investors and lots of Stockopedia subscribers I know invested a lot in Purple Bricks and Burford Capital. This is again from the company blog. Among the positive performers in 2017 were Burford Capital and Purple Bricks. These are both young, dynamic businesses that are proving highly disruptive in their respective industries. We're confident that both companies can continue to grow rapidly in the years ahead. In the context of this growth, their shares continue to look profoundly undervalued. Well, Purple Bricks, profoundly undervalued when they invested, when that was quoted, 72% decline since. At the time, a stock rank of 18, poor quality, very expensive, unproven business model. Lots of capital raisings, too much cash consumption. It's been a bit of a sore loser. Burford Capital, I know many people, many private investors much smarter than me, still back it. And to be fair, I think Woodford's still up 40% at least on their original investment, or more maybe. But profoundly undervalued here. We all know what's happened with Burford. A 33% decline since on shorting attack. But again, it was very profitable, but that's, you know, the shorting attack is all about how transparent the accounting has been around those declared profits. But anyway, Burford Capital, I think you can see the overconfidence. What I'm trying to say is the overconfidence of Woodford Capital about profound undervaluation in cases like this may not have been as substantiated as they thought. 2018, and I'm going fast because I know I'm under time pressure. 2018. Outflows are gathering. Remember, they started to get this wave of redemptions. And what have you got to do in an open-ended fund? This is not a closed investment trust. This is an open-ended fund, so people can redeem at any time. Anyone running an open-ended fund knows that they've got to have a buffer for people that want their money back. It's open-ended. So if you've got people redeeming, you've got to pay them back. That's why people that run open-ended funds don't tend to buy lots and lots of unquoted stocks. You know, because you just can't sell unquoted stocks. It's so difficult. But the thing is, as I showed you earlier, it wasn't only the unquoted stocks that were the issue. He bought lots and lots more small and very speculative listed shares where there's no liquidity either. And that causes big problems when you have redemptions. So he started selling most of the liquid safe stocks. There's no AstraZeneca's, Glaxo's, Roche's, Sanaf, you know, all of those have gone. And you're seeing more and more and more of these very, very speculative names in the top holdings. You know, a lot of these were down here early and they've all shot up. So he was under a lot of pressure. And what's he having to do? He's having to sell his safe quality names because they're the only ones you can sell because there's liquidity. So big sales, this is the sectors again, big sales of liquid pharma and tobacco stocks. That healthcare bet come way down from 40% to 20-something percent, selling loads of those tobacco shares. He's like having to redeem like all these names that were spine of the portfolio to meet redemptions. And this is 2018, end of 2018. This is the risk ratings. Conservative shares, which were 54% of the portfolio back in 2014 is now 6.5% of the portfolio. Unlisted, highly speculatives and speculatives creeping up to almost 3/4 of the portfolio. I mean, to see this in a multi-billion fund and to imagine what was going on internally as they scrambled to raise funds, I can't even imagine. So it's extraordinary seeing the shift in the portfolio. And now a minority invested in large caps. Large caps, remember, when he started in 2014, that was 75%, 74% of the portfolio. Now it's 21%. Micro caps, small caps, and unlisted, suddenly, you know, that's definitely more than a third. So you've seen these huge transitions. This is a slide I put together. Which shows the holdings between from the end 2016 portfolio and looking at all the holdings that we get data for and seeing what the performance of all those shares was from that date, December 2016, until the portfolio closed in October 2019. And this paints a picture because this is performance. So these are shares that have gone up. These ones, they've gone up to the right of that line, and these are shares which have gone down, lost, you know, they've gone down, negative return. And red lines are the ones that he sold in between, from that period to the end period. And you can see that there is a huge concentration of red sold shares of the shares that went up. And there's less of those in the shares that went down. And in fact, the ones that went down the most, not sold at all. Now, what's the classic thing we're told as investors? Run your winners, sell your losers, right? That's a key, you know, it's the key to making money in the stock market. Why did he have to sell his winners? He was forced to because he had to raise funds. And when things are going up, there are buyers. So he was able to sell into strength. When things are going down, there's often no liquidity. You can't sell. And I think this paints a really sorry picture of what was going on in the fund during that period. Peter Lynch, selling your winners and holding your losers is like cutting the flowers and watering the weeds. That's what he had to do. Cut his flowers, water his weeds. The portfolio got worse. The garden got weedier and weedier, choking the flowers. Now, I like to look at hit rates or win rates on portfolios. This chart shows you, this is actually the FTSE All Share. This shows you between 2016 and 2019 of all the shares in the FTSE All Share. How many were winners and how many were losers? 51% of the FTSE All Share were winners. A monkey throwing darts at the FTSE All Share to pick a portfolio would have won more average, on average, more than they lost. So you're probably just buying 20 random shares from the FTSE All Share, you'd probably have found that half your portfolio were winners, half were losers. The Woodford portfolio, 72% were losers, 27% were winners. Britain's Buffett, just saying. I mean, it's a really astonishing picture. This is just a case study. It just shows you AstraZeneca. Not a great deal. In 2018, not a great deal has changed as far as the investment case for AstraZeneca is concerned, but a lot of other stocks have become increasingly attractive from a valuation perspective. He had to sell his big liquid names, and unfortunately, he sold AstraZeneca right there, and it's gone up 70% since. There are lots of cases like this. In Rolls-Royce, he sold in 2014 right at the bottom. I mean, I think there's a confluence of factors at play. He had a string of bad luck, but also a string of bad decision-making. And, you know, this is a more quality, better quality name. 2019, the last portfolio, I'm nearly at the end. Hargreaves Lansdown, marketing. All of that, remember, all of that's gone on. This is not the first time in his career that Woodford's underperformed the market, but we've stuck with him through difficult times in the past. Investors have been rewarded for their patience. We retain our conviction in him to deliver excellent long-term performance, and the fund remains on the Wealth 50. May 2019, 1 month later, it closed. You know, it makes me wonder what's going on at Hargreaves Lansdown, that they didn't know what was going on in the fund. If they looked like we've looked now, I wish I'd looked then, but if they looked at all the analytics that I've shown you, they would have known what was going on in the fund and they wouldn't have come out with statements like this. And I think, you know, I got all the marketing material from Hargreaves Lansdown, I never invested, but it was always an incredible picture of him in open shirt, you know, Britain's Buffett. The marketing all the way through was was very aggressive. 2019. Now, this is interesting because at the end, he started restructuring the portfolio, and especially it was all gated. I think we got this in June 2019. But he'd done a big restructuring towards less volatile and more cyclical value stocks. You started to see, I think, in bold, some of the five biggest adds to the portfolio that year. Imperial Brands, again, Taylor Wimpey, BT Group, BAT. These are the biggest top five biggest buys that year. And you can see suddenly he's made a play back into that top right of that bubble chart. You know, I showed you earlier, it started up here, went down there in 2016, and now he's made a late play back into the kind of shares one might have expected Woodford to buy. The sector shift between 2016 and 2019, that 40% healthcare sector bet that he'd had suddenly massively reduced, and he's shifted back into cyclicals. And again, you know, this is another astonishing style shift. The huge momentum play that he'd had has suddenly cut. Quality gone up again. Value, he'd made a big bet on more value stocks again. So remember, he'd gone three big pictures of the portfolio from you know, this whole dynamic, and I'll show you in a summary chart in a moment. But then, of course, this whole fund was shut down and he closed his operation. This was Link's decision and one I cannot accept, nor believe is in the long-term interests of Woodford Equity Income Fund investors. They've taken the painful decision to close Woodford Investment Management. You have to look at the picture that was being painted and wonder whether it was actually in their best interests. Now, I've summarized a lot of those charts I've just shown you into some timelines, and I just want to run you through them. Firstly, the quality value momentum of the portfolio started in 2014 as this good quality portfolio of leading shares. And in 2 years, the quality of the portfolio, of the holdings of the portfolio, had radically reduced. And it just began to recover as he made that scramble back into more quality names. The speculative zenith of the portfolio, the peak assets under management, it was not what people had signed up for. The average value, so the cheapness of the shares, dropped. More speculative, more expensive names here. And then this late play into cheap shares. I think he suddenly got back his value investing wings right at the end. But the average value of the portfolio, he made this late play into value stocks. But I think this is really interesting, this dominance of momentum at the zenith of the portfolio in 2017. And I like to summarize, I know I skipped over those styles just to save time, but I classify this from QVM, quality value momentum perspective, that he was in what I would call leading shares or the high-flying shares, high-quality, high-momentum shares at the beginning of the portfolio. And often you see that profile in those big cap, sort of more big cap, things like the premium healthcare, pharma stocks, etc. But there is no doubt about it. This is a momentum trap portfolio in 2017, strong momentum bet, poor quality, poor value. And then he made this big shift back into contrarian shares, higher quality, higher value shares. Now, to see these kinds of style shifts in a portfolio, a fund that ran $10 billion at its peak, I think is remarkable. I think it's really astonishing. Most professional investors have quite a lot of discipline in how they go about their investing. And I know a lot of really great fund managers who are much more disciplined in their contrarian style or a tendency to buy certain styles of shares. And I think this is, it just shows what it was so loose at Woodford, what was going on. This is the allocation to higher risk shares. Remember I showed you the slide, the payoff to speculative and highly speculative shares is quite negative, especially amongst highly speculative shares when you buy a lot of them. So this is speculative, that's highly speculative, and this is unlisted shares, unquoted. And it became more than 50% of the portfolio at the end in all three of these categories. And you can see what was going on in the risk controls at the company at this time. And this as all that those flow of funds came in, this massive speculative bet that then meant they had to unwind all of their safe conservative shares. So at the beginning, remember, conservative and balanced shares was almost 80% of the portfolio, more than 50% in the lowest risk segment of the market. And as time went on, it just The exposure to those just drop, drop, drop. I mean, I really should show you that quote from Woodford at the beginning. I believe I can find enough safe, reliable investments to make better risk-adjusted returns. He started and he did that, and then just what happened? And this is the allocation across size groups. Not sure if you can see the colors, but this is the large cap exposure, 3/4 of the portfolio in large caps. I mean, you expect in a fund that big, you know, you're going to buy a lot of big caps. You know, think about Fundsmith or big funds like that. You've really got to meet a lot of your liabilities, a lot of the in an open-ended fund. So large caps, just a massive drop. More and more in unlisted and small caps as time went on. I know a lot of this picture is exacerbated by that massive redemptions that he got, because he just from 2017 he had to sell everything, you know, that he could sell. This just shows you the enormity of that healthcare pharma biotech bet that he had at end 2016, almost 40% of the portfolio. Not sure what happened there. I mean, a private investor portfolio might see these sorts of bets. And this again just shows you, this is more of an aside, but it shows you this shift that he made out of, well, consumer defensive category. That, to be honest, is a lot of tobacco stocks. We know they have long-term concerns, but he made this huge shift from defensive to cyclicals. And this is a lot of house builders in that. But, you know, there's a lot of risk that, you know, he was still betting large, even right at the end. You know, big, big cyclicals bet, you know, and, you know, you know, we're quite uncertain times anyway. I just want to finish with this one slide, because there are some lessons for private investors. Anybody, you know, could take away. I have given a lot of this data to the FT. They asked for it. I'm hoping that we get a bit more exposure for some of this, in these insights, because I think the press have focused a lot on just anecdotal evidence rather than more statistical evidence. And I think there's a real story here. But I think in running your own portfolio as an equities investor, or any fund manager, to be honest, there are some really, really obvious points. Remember, you might be wrong. Even gods can fall from high places. But also overconfidence. It's the classic behavioral bias. My most expensive mistakes have come from behavioral bias of being overconfident, believing I was so smart and buying masses of certain stocks. You might be wrong. You more often actually are than you think. Focus on high expected return stocks. And I know, like, you know, I know subscribers will know that we use the stock ranks as a bit of a proxy for this. And not at all saying you only got to buy high stock rank shares whatsoever. But, you know, I think what is the key insight from the stock ranks is that you want to have a lower proportion of your portfolio in sort of lower ranking kinds of shares, because it's a bit like investing against a headwind. You know, if you put those factors behind you, you know, profitable shares, you know, et cetera, you're investing with more of a tailwind. And I think that does help when you're building a portfolio. And I think that's where a lot of Woodford went wrong. Keep a low exposure to speculative shares. There's nothing wrong with having a punt. Everybody likes a punt. I bet on Japan against Ireland. I mean, fantastic, 16-1. How good is that? I don't bet on sports that often. But when you see an outlier, fantastic. You know, it's always important to have the odds. You know, more or I don't like to call it gambling. Leon, you wouldn't like to call it gambling, would you? It's like you're investing confidence in shares where you've got information that you believe the market doesn't have. But I would say that, you know, ensuring lower exposure to more speculative names will lead to a better likelihood of a long-term good outcome. Ensure diversification across sectors. I mean, you don't need to overdo it, but, you know, don't do single sector bets, you know, unless you have huge, you know, information that other people don't. But I see very, very often private investors have got all their portfolio in energy and mining shares, for example, or all of it in biotech. And it can go really well for a while, but then you get stuck and you refuse to back out. So diversify across. And of course, there's some really great sectors which have actually led to sort of the majority of stock market returns over time. But, you know, making sure you've got exposure to them just is a good idea. Now, we might all go, oh, Woodford, what a ninny. But if you are fully invested in micro caps, you know, and a bear market comes along and you need the money, you're going to find you have a very bad situation because you won't find any bidders for your shares. So if you do invest in microcaps, and I know at Stockvidio, like on the small cap report, we often, Graham's there, and Graham and Paul often cover a lot of what we would classify as microcaps under 50 million market cap shares, often a lot larger ones. Graham, you love lots of, you know, mid caps and bigger shares too. But, you know, amongst the smaller shares in the market, there often isn't that much liquidity. I'm sure if any of you gone out and tried to buy them, you find that, you know, you can get a bit of a spike in the price if you don't control your limit in the order. But on the other side, it's very, very hard. So you can't get liquidity when you're wanting to sell. So, you know, unless you've got very, very long time frames and you don't need the money, but if, you know, that it's fine. And you know, I think you've got to like just make sure that if you do go and have to go and pay for children's education or for, you know, your holiday home, whatever you want, just keep that. You got to match your assets and your liabilities, right? And the last one, sell your losers, run your winners. Okay. It's funny thing is, whenever if I come often at Mellor and you say to me, do you use a stop loss or do you average down? If you know. Normally it's like a heresy to say, oh, you stop loss. And I'm going to scoff at you and tell you you're nonsense. Most people here are far too smart. Averaging down can work very well if you're right. But there is a thing called the disposition effect, and it's a well-known anomaly, behavioral bias that we've all got. And it basically means that when shares go up, people tend to sell them because they think, oh, God, it's a new high. It's going to drop again. Oh, it's a bit, it's like, a you know, they can't imagine it can keep going up. And when they sell, they go, oh, I'm never selling that. It's worth way more than that. And so ironically, you get less selling than there should be when shares drop, and you get less buying than there should be when shares go up. And that is what creates momentum. But it's also why, as a something to train yourself into, is to sell your losers, run your winners. And of course, when you're in a bit of a liquidity trap, unfortunately, you can't do it. As we showed, Woodford couldn't do it. He had to sell all his winners. You know, that is, I think, one of the best traits you can have in your investing. Anyway, that was really it. That's all I wanted to say. And thanks a lot for listening. Hope it was useful. Cheers.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.